Welcome to the deep dive. You've handed us a stack of sources, and wow, they tell two really interconnected but almost contradictory stories about American politics right now.
They really do. On one hand, you've got these election results suggesting this huge surge of momentum for one side.
Yeah, the blue team.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, we have the federal government just ground to a complete halt, frozen.
Exactly. So our mission today, it's kind of split. First, we need to understand that sheer poll-defying strength we saw from Democrats in those off-year elections. Think New Jersey, Virginia, those big city races.
Okay.
And second, we have to synthesize what people are saying, the impacts, the theories, the predictions about this government shutdown, which, well, it just smashed the record.
Right. So the big question we're framing this whole deep dive around is pretty simple. Did that undeniable momentum we saw in the states, did it actually travel, 3,000 miles to Washington and break the stalemate? Or not?
That's the core puzzle. Let's start with those governor races because the margins were just surprising.
We have to, yeah. Because the story isn't just the Democrats won, it's how much the polls seem to have missed it.
Completely missed it in some cases. New Jersey's probably the prime example, wouldn't you say?
I think so, right? Mikey Sherrill won the governorship pretty decisively over Jack Ciattarelli, the Republican. But the final margin, 56.2% to 43.2%. That's a full 13 points.
A 13-point win. And that margin, that's the proof of a dramatic polling failure. The aggregators, they had Sherrill's lead somewhere between, 3 and 5 points?
Yeah, roughly. 3 to maybe 6 points max in most forecasts.
And the analysts in your sources, they pretty much agree. Almost no single poll even got close to double digits for her lead.
So here's the really crucial insight, I think. The plausible explanation isn't just, people lied to pollsters. It's more that the pollsters fundamentally got the electorate wrong.
They modeled it incorrectly.
Exactly. They just whiffed completely on who was actually going to show up. Probably underestimated Democratic turnout, especially for an off year, and maybe overestimated how engaged the Republican base was going to be.
And we saw a similar dynamic play out in Virginia, didn't we? Although the polling miss there was maybe slightly less profound.
Abigail Spanberger won there by 15.2 points, so 57.5% to 42.3%. Still a huge margin.
Still huge. And the average missed by pollsters was about 5.5 points. Mm-hmm. Still definitely outside the margin of error, but it just confirms that trend. A major undercount of Democratic support.
But hang on, why do people always say Virginia is more predictive of the national mood than New Jersey? Is it just because it's closer to D.C.? Or is there some other reason?
Well, proximity probably helps a bit, sure. Hmm. But there's a critical structural reason. Virginia's state constitution, it actually prohibits governors from serving consecutive terms.
Oh, right. Yeah. So every election is an open seat.
Exactly. Every single time. It's an open contest. It's not clouded by any effects of incumbency. So that makes it a much cleaner snapshot of the political environment at that moment.
Okay, that makes sense.
And if you connect that to the historical analysis and the sources you gave us, the pattern seems to hold up. When Democrats win these governor races by 5 points or more, which they absolutely did in both states in 2025, they have historically tended to do pretty well in the House elections the following year.
That feels like a powerful indicator then. Okay, let's broaden out from just the governor's race in Virginia, because the wins there had immediate, structural consequences for map drawing and power.
Oh, absolutely. The victory wasn't just Spanberger at the top. You had Ghazala Hashmi, the lieutenant governor-elect, winning by over 11 points. Big historical firsts there, too.
Yeah, first person of Asian descent, first Muslim to hold statewide office in Virginia. That's significant.
Definitely. And the attorney general-elect, Jay Jones, also won comfortably.
But the really, really consequential win, you're saying, came in the legislature.
That's where the ground really shifted. Democrats flipped 13 seats in the House of Delegates. That gave them, at minimum, a 64-35 majority.
Which means they established a full party. Trifecta, is that the term?
Trifecta, exactly. And we should probably clarify that for the listener. A trifecta just means one party controls the governorship, the state senate, and the state house. It's total control, basically.
Well, full power.
And in Virginia, the implications are especially high because of that unique constitutional setup we mentioned. The governor cannot veto map changes passed by the legislature.
Wow. Okay. So legislative control alone is enough.
It's enough to draw new district lines as long as those changes get approved by two consecutive legislative sessions.
Ah, okay. So by winning this trifecta now, Democrats have cleared the first hurdle.
They've got requirement one done. They'll complete the second half when the new session starts in January. And that gives them the runway to push through some pretty ambitious gerrymandering goals.
And the sources say the specific goal is?
Setting up the party to win 3 more U.S. House seats than they currently hold. That's the target.
The stakes are huge then. What about New Jersey? They kept their trifecta too, right?
They did. Democrats maintained their trifecta there. But the source material suggests that trying to gerrymander before 2028 faces a much steeper path legally. It's time-consuming, so Virginia is really the immediate prize.
Got it. And we shouldn't just skip over the city results either.
No, definitely not. That city sweep was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the sources list these enormous, almost unbelievable margins for Democrats or, you know, nonpartisans who lean blue. Like 78.9 points in Atlanta, 75 points in Pittsburgh.
It's wild. And what's fascinating there, the sort of synthetic takeaway, is that these huge margins show that really intensely organized local progressive efforts can get results that you rarely see in national politics.
So these aren't just local races disconnected from everything else.
Not at all. They're almost like a proof of concept for that hyper-local grassroots organizing. And it serves as a pretty clear warning shot to maybe moderates across the country that the progressive base is fired up.
Okay, shifting focus now. New York City. The left made a big statement there too, right? Zoran Mamdani won the mayoral race.
Won it comfortably, yeah. Took about 50.4% against a field that notably included Andrew Cuomo trying a comeback.
And the prediction is he instantly becomes this major progressive standard bearer alongside people like AOC.
That's the expectation. But it raises this really interesting national diegetic. The sources predict Mamdani will immediately become a symbol for the right.
A target, you mean?
Exactly. Targeted in campaigns all over the country, whether his actual policies affect anyone outside New York or not. It's that strategy of sort of weaponizing high-profile figures to motivate the opposition everywhere else.
Interesting. Okay, but to see the real power of the, let's call it the anti-Trump vote. You have to look west, right? California, Proposition 50.
Yeah, 3,000 miles west. Prop 50 passed in a landslide, 63.8% to 36.2%. Huge win.
And Prop 50, that's the one designed to let California gerrymander its districts, potentially pick up more Democratic seats in Congress.
That's the mechanism, yes. But the motivation behind the vote, that's the key insight here. They did exit polling of people who voted yes on 50.
What do they find?
75% said they voted yes specifically to oppose Donald Trump. And 70% said they voted yes to oppose national Republicans.
Wow. So it wasn't really about the specifics of the proposition itself for most voters.
It seems not. I mean, the takeaway is pretty clear. This overwhelming win is seen as proof of concept for figures like Governor Newsom, who backed it, and definitely a significant poke in the eye for Donald Trump. It was a win fueled almost entirely by that anti-Trump feeling.
That's powerful stuff. And when we look at the other ballot propositions you highlighted, we see these really clear ideological splits happening at the same time, right?
Absolutely. You look at Maine, for instance, they voted not to make voting harder, passed 63.9% to 36.1%, and they passed a measure giving judges power to take guns away from dangerous individuals. Pretty liberal outcome.
Okay, but then contrast that with Texas.
Totally different story. Texas propositions made it harder to grant bail and gave parents significantly more power over, like, curriculum decisions and child upbringing stuff.
Yeah.
Very conservative priorities winning out at the state level there.
And Colorado.
Colorado voted to keep free school lunches, and they decided to fund it by raising taxes on incomes over $300,000. So again, you see the electorate is highly mobilized, but achieving results kind of all across the ideological spectrum, depending on the state.
So the elections show this undeniable momentum, clearly. But the question remains, can that momentum travel 3,000 miles to D.C. and break this historic deadlock?
That really is the central issue, isn't it? Because by the time you, the listener, are hearing this deep dive, the government shutdown will have officially broken the record. We're sitting at 36 days and counting.
It's a deeply concerning benchmark. And the sources point out Donald Trump has now been president during both of the two longest shutdowns in American history.
That's a fact. And here's where those two narratives, the blue momentum and the D.C. deadlock, really collide. That strong election performance, it's likely to stiffen the resolve of Democrats in Congress who might have been wavering.
Makes sense. Give them more spine, maybe.
While at the same time, those losses in NJ and VA, they have to make at least some Republicans nervous about the political cost of this whole crisis dragging on.
So what's the actual fight about at its core? The sources mention rescissions and Obamacare subsidies.
Right. The core fight centers on those two things. And maybe we should clarify rescissions for the listener. It's basically when the executive branch tries to cancel spending that Congress already approved.
Okay. Clawing back money.
Exactly. And critics see this as giving the president and the Office of Management and Budget way too much power, essentially shifting budget control away from Congress. And then there are the expiring Obamacare subsidies, which is a huge issue for millions of people.
Right. So we looked at that readership survey you did a few weeks back, and the collective wisdom was pretty strong, wasn't it?
It really was. 86.2% of readers correctly guessed the shutdown would break the record. They seem to know how Congress works, or maybe fails to work.
Ah, yeah. Pessimism or realism?
A bit of both, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
The average prediction for when it would end was 43 days, so readers expected it to drag on until about December 1st.
But the theories on what would actually break the stalemate, those were really different, right?
Oh, yeah, starkly different camps. The arguments for it ending soon were mostly rooted in political pain and self-preservation.
Like what specifically?
Readers thought Republicans might just cave after those election losses. Or maybe once the public really started feeling the pain directly through specific high-profile things.
Right, right.
Like messing with Thanksgiving travel, that was a big one people mentioned. Or disrupting Black Friday sales. Or just the direct financial hit when those Obamacare premium increases suddenly land in people's bank accounts. Things people notice immediately.
Okay, so pressure points. What about the theories for it lasting a long time?
Those arguments were much more focused on, like, institutional strategy and maybe stubbornness. Some argued that the rescissions issue itself is absolutely central to the plan from OMB Director Russell Vought.
The idea being Trump uses that to avoid looking like he lost.
Exactly. To negate any perception that the Democrats won whatever compromise eventually happens.
And what else? Any other breaking points mentioned?
Yeah, a really potent one predicted was the moment troops stopped getting paid. That would create massive coordinated pressure from military families calling their representatives. That could be huge.
You'd think so.
And then there was a darker prediction from some readers, basically saying it won't end until Trump is actually out of office. That he seems to prefer governing by executive order and threats rather than through actual cooperation with Congress.
Grim. And we have to bring this back down from the political theory to the human cost, right? Because people are dealing with this right now.
We absolutely must. The sources you provided include reports from readers highlighting those costs, clear signs, they say, of the economy potentially tipping towards recession because of this uncertainty.
And specific stories, too.
Yeah. One person shared a story about someone they know waiting for a federal pension to process. Just waiting.
Yeah.
And because the government process is totally frozen, that person is now homeless.
God, that's awful. This is way more than just political theater.
It absolutely is. We saw accounts of federal employees already looking for new jobs because they can't take the instability. Core IT systems are failing.
Failing how?
Things like mistaken terminations happening because the system glitched, or essential workers losing all their records, training records, sick leave because the IT people who could fix the databases are furloughed. It's just institutional decay happening in real time.
Wow.
And what's really fascinating here is the consensus that seemed to emerge among the readers you surveyed, a feeling that the underlying system is flawed, no matter who's in charge at the moment.
Meaning the budget process itself.
Yeah, strong criticism of the fundamental way we do budgets, where they just sort of expire instead of, say, continuing monthly by default unless Congress actively changes something.
That structure is what enables the shutdowns as a political weapon in the first place, isn't it?
Yeah.
It absolutely is. And there were these deep concerns that the tools being used now, shutdowns, the filibuster, they're actively eroding public trust in Congress itself, the very body that's supposed to be the most democratic, the most responsive to the people.
That erosion of trust feels really dangerous long term.
It does. And one reader who lives in Germany offered this incredibly thought-provoking historical warning. It really drives home how severe legislative deadlock can become.
What was the warning?
Their grandfather observed how the German parliament back in the 1930s basically squandered its own reputation through what he called self-imposed blockades, just constant infighting and paralysis.
Okay. And the consequence.
That loss of public confidence, that feeling that Parliament couldn't get anything done, it allowed Hitler to come along and impress people simply by taking action, by doing things, bringing about change. Even if that change turned out to be utterly destructive, the public was just desperate for someone to break the gridlock.
That is a really sobering comparison. It underscores the danger when legislative bodies seem incapable of functioning.
It really does. Now, in terms of the outcome of this current shutdown, the reader predictions for the Democrats were pretty realistic, I thought. Almost half, 48.5%, predicted they'd get maybe one major concession, like extending those ACA subsidies.
But not a total victory.
No, and only 11% thought they'd get absolutely nothing. So the challenge for Democrats is showing they have the endurance to actually fight for that one concession.
Okay, so let's synthesize. We've really dug into two major forces playing out over the last few weeks. First, there's this undeniable poll-defying momentum for Democrats in key state and local races,
mm-hmm.
often fueled by that intense anti-Trump feeling we saw, especially with Prop 50.
Right. And at the exact same time, concurrently, we have this escalating, record-setting government shutdown. And it seems rooted in a really deep institutional breakdown where trust, compromise, even basic government functions are just visibly eroding day by day.
The election results, the mandate they represent, that's very real. Tangible wins.
Definitely real. But here's the final question, the one for you, the listener, to really consider and explore on your own. Can that state-level popular mandate, those big wins in Virginia and New Jersey, can they actually challenge the kind of institutional inertia and legislative hostility that just defines Washington, D.C. today?
Or will those victories ultimately just get overshadowed by the continuing deadlock? Will the shutdown swamp everything else?
That's the tension. That's what we'll be watching unfold.
And it's a tension that will absolutely define the weeks ahead. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into your source material.